This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
It's Trumpcast 2017. It's going to be absolutely tremendous, I have to tell you.
Democrats are putting it out because they suffered one of the greatest defeats in the history of politics in this country.
What the hell is that dude talking about? I don't understand this. His boss has come out and already drawn conclusions and said, I don't believe them.
If he's going to have any credibility as president, he needs to stop talking this way. He needs to stop denigrating the intelligence community.
Get the facts. The facts are there about Russian behavior.
Hello and welcome to Trumpcast. I'm Virginia Heffernan. I'm introducing a breakthrough idea long suppressed under the evil Obama administration. I'm saying Joyeux December 28th. Finally, we can say it, Joyeux December 28th. Doesn't that feel good? Liberation at last. I'm sure you didn't touch Twitter over the break, so I hope you're detoxed and refreshed and ready to dive back in. And let me just say that while you were out, nothing got better. But when we were off scarfing figgy pudding and playing with Hatchimals, reporters did keep their heads down, and we got a flood of reports and editorials, in particular about how cracked and undermined American information space is. We now know from the Wall Street Journal that Robert Mueller has requested information from Cambridge Analytica. I love when Mueller requests things, requests. And Cambridge Analytica is, of course, the data firm that the Trump campaign used during the 2016 presidential race. The Washington Post published an editorial by Paul Waldman called Russia is going to attack our next election and the Trump administration may not even try to stop it. And the Washington Post also published an op-ed by former CIA Director Michael Morell and former chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Representative Mike Rogers. He's a Republican. So remember, not exactly real hysterics, these guys, not exactly doing the bidding of Democrats trying to undermine Trump's great victory. These are cyber and information hawks, and they argue in their amazing op-ed that Russia has continued its cyber attacks against the United States. They also serve on the Advisory Council for the Alliance for Securing Democracy. I mention this thing all the time on Trumpcast because it has an extraordinary feature called the Hamilton 68 dashboard that really tracks how bots are used to disseminate propaganda that's designed to weaken the country and its democracy. What these guys say, that's Morell and Rogers, say that there's a perception among the media and general public that Russia ended its social media operations following last year's election, but that's wrong. Russia information ops in the United States continued after the election and to this day. The New York Times had an op-ed by Yair Rosenberg of Tablet Magazine about his efforts, one man's efforts, to counter anti-Semitic attacks on Twitter using a bot designed to spot imposter trolls, and Twitter's ultimate censoring of his bot in favor of the neo-Nazis, who once again rampage through the sites. But at the heart of all this is a blockbuster piece in the Washington Post from December 25th called Kremlin Trolls Burned Across the Internet as Washington Debated Options by Adam Entus, Ellen Nakashima, and Greg Jaffe. So I love this headline, Kremlin Trolls Burned Across the Internet as Washington Debated Options, because what you find out when you get into the piece is that Washington really dithered and equivocated about how exactly to handle Kremlin trolls, which they knew existed and, you know, came or set about influencing the election. The headline brings to mind Nero fiddled while Rome burned. And, you know, that expression really does suggest the extent of the damage that was done by these operations. My guest today to talk about this piece is one of its authors, Ellen Nakashima, who covers national security for The Washington Post. She'll be with me in a minute. Joining Joining me on the line is Ellen Nakashima, who covers national security for The Washington Post, to talk about her piece about Kremlin trolls and the effort to counter them. Welcome, Ellen.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
So sometimes it seems like what we've been doing on TrumpCast since the election is telling a detective story. We started with a dead body in November 2016. Let's call that the United States of America. And now we are trying to figure out who did it, who put Trump in power. And there are many, many suspects, but among them are the Russians and in particular, Russian information warfare. So you at The Washington Post with your colleagues, Greg Jaffe and Adam Entus, have written this extraordinary piece about Kremlin trolls and the efforts in Washington to stem the tide of them that ultimately didn't work or didn't implement. Walk me through this piece a little bit.
We started out with the goal of trying to understand what the United States government had done in the area of information operations, especially vis-a-vis the Russians, and how the government came to sort of cede the battlefield to the Russians. And we did a lot of reporting, much of which actually didn't make it into the finished piece, just for lack of space.
Yeah.
Some of which, you know, went back to the Cold War. And then obviously we knew what happened was we found that with the end of the Cold War and the peace dividend, there was a sense that the propaganda war was over, the battle had been won by the United States. We didn't need to do information warfare or information operations against the Soviets or the Russians. And the covert finding that had existed during the Cold War that enabled such operations was lifted, and it was no longer. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the U.S. Information Agency, the USIA, the mm-hmm. big information propaganda agency run by the U.S. government, was disbanded at the end of the Cold War. And nothing really took its place. In the sort of ensuing years, there were sporadic efforts, largely by the U.S. Army, to kind of flex its muscles in information operations in the Balkans, in North Africa. But those efforts really never gained traction for a variety of reasons. And then, of course, after 9/11, the big focus was on counterterrorism.
Tell me about, say, what some of those operations in the Balkans, what is in the 90s were, or beginning, say, in the 90s or in Africa.
Yeah, yeah.
What, you know, just by showing us what information warfare or counter-information warfare looks like.
So there was an information operations officer named Austin Branch who started experimenting with things like creating websites, names like the Balkan Times, for instance, that was set up to do counter propaganda against Slobodan Milosevic. Now, and it would be a site that would mix, information and news with sports and sort of entertainment to try to draw in a broader audience. And all of this was supposedly, was supposed to be fact-based information. It wasn't fake news or deception or created news or propaganda, but it was information that was being put out to promote sort of the Western ideals and counter Milosevic's propaganda. And then later he branched into sort of some websites that were aimed at Northern African audiences. And what he ran into was some skepticism, especially on the Hill, from Congress, from aides who were saying, like, well, just prove, how do you prove what you're doing is having any impact, is having any effect? And it was just very hard to gauge how you were changing minds or opinions. And that's always been the challenge in influence operations. To this day.
Right. And there had been, during the Cold War, there had been so many, in some cases, operations that seemed silly or wasteful or just kind of cloak and dagger spy games. in retrospect, that I can imagine Congress saying we need to shrink this budget. It needs to be results oriented.
Exactly.
Gauging the changes to hearts and minds. I remember in particular a friend of mine's grandfather was involved with the CIA during the Bay of Pigs. And he said one of the things they had done in Cuba was drop big condoms for this for the American soldiers to indicate to Cubans that that you know these guys were like super powerful and well endowed and so on. But I mean, those were the kind of things that these like CIA elite right. CIA people did toward changing hearts and minds and making the making Americans seem fearsome. And when you look back on that after the Cold War, it just seemed like America had kind of won on its merits, and we didn't need to do this like you know. Expensive, profligate kind of self-advertising anymore. But maybe we did, because the Kremlin made no such decision about the impotence of information warfare.
That's right. And then also keep in mind that there's been a law on the books for a while that also bans any propaganda or influence type operations that might have an effect on American audiences, that could blow back and affect Americans' attitudes or opinions.
You mean Americans living abroad or
no, in Americans in the U.S. in particular.
I see. So American if they saw audiences. Like very jingoistic Clash of Civilizations propaganda there, they might think of that as... what, imperialistic or something else, something more subtle than that?
I mean, it could have been something more subtle. The government didn't want to be affecting U.S. population, you know, the American society's opinions or views based on propaganda that was aimed at influencing audiences abroad. So
got
there
it.
Was that ban that they were working with. And then another factor was during the 90s into the 2000s, in some quarters, for instance, I remember we interviewed Mike Hayden, who was in the mid-90s the head of Air Force Intelligence, and he said we had a big internal debate in the mid-90s over whether to go with information dominance or cyber dominance. And cyber would be a subset of information dominance. But he says... For a variety of reasons, some of them good, we ended up going with cyber dominance and casting aside the, you know, not taking the path of information dominance, which includes psychological operations, deception, influence operations, as well as cyber.
I remember as recently as a year ago, thinking that that the Kremlin can't have had in mind simply, you know, some kind of dominance of information space or infection or infestation of information space. They must be moving toward knocking out the power grids or bringing down the American internet or some other more cyber looking or, you know, or mm-hmm. even drones.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just, you know, like the U.S. government, did not think that influence operations and information warfare could be so effective.
Right.
And so tell me about, you know, how we missed it, or at least how what you say is this counterintelligence operation called mm-hmm. Northern Night ended up not going anywhere, not going far enough.
Well, Northern Night was the name of an FBI counterintelligence investigation that was tracking Russian sock puppets or fake personas on social media dating back to at least the fall of 2015. And they were identifying personas such as the one we wrote about, Alice Donovan, who as a creation of a Russian military psychological operations officer was writing articles or plagiarizing articles in some cases and getting them placed in U.S. and Canadian outlets initially to build up her bona fides, and then increasingly during the campaign to amplify a message that was to undermine Hillary Clinton and promote Donald Trump, which was just clearly in line with the Kremlin's goals. Their overall their overall mission or goal was to just really stoke divisions in the United States, just as they had been doing in Western Europe, to undermine the notion of Western liberal democracy and, by comparison, make their form of government society look better or at least not as bad. And if that meant helping Trump win, so be it. This was all part of a bigger, broader game to try to undermine the concepts of democracy and so, as you've heard, discord in the U.S. populace.
So let's look at Alice Donovan's CV. I mean, you call her a sock puppet, and I do think this year has introduced people who don't live on social media to some of the phantoms that have haunted it since the beginning. Sock puppets are, of course, I mean, I remember sock puppet scandals from, the early part of this century as more like someone posing, giving his own books a good review, posing as someone else.
Right.
So it all seemed fairly, I mean, that's the reason I bring up the condom story in Cuba, is some of the stuff seems so silly, and yet it can be so effective.
Yep.
So you all note that the email comes at 3:26 a.m. One of the sort of fingerprints that Muscovites and Kremlin agents somehow decided to leave is that the bots often appear in the morning, the middle of the day in Moscow, but the morning U.S. time.
Right.
The emails come at that time too. You'd think that
exactly.
They would cover their tracks more, but apparently in this case they leave it. So she writes this note to counterpunch, and then what she like starts pitching stories, or she starts just writing stories and uploading stories. And what does the staff at Counterpunch do about the stuff she is uploading, and why don't they recognize it?
Yeah, so my colleague Adam Entis interviewed Jeffrey St. Clair, the editor of Counterpunch, who until Adam contacted him in late November had no idea that Alice was a creation, was not fake, was not who she said she was. And he had, evidently run a number of her articles. And then once he was informed that the FBI suspected she was a persona, he asked her for some form of identification to at least, show that she was who she said she was, like a beginning freelance journalist. Mm-hmm. And as we say in the article, she said she, for security reasons, no longer wanted to be in touch and really just sort of ceased communicating with the editor.
So why did she appeal to them to begin with? I mean, there's so many freelancers, and also were they paying her?
I don't know whether or not she was paid, but I suspect because they're not a very big organization that they probably depend on a lot of work from freelancers to fill their pages.
Yeah.
Again, this gets back to what we were saying earlier. It's hard to know or to gauge just what impact any of these articles did. But she was one of many in a field of crowded field of trolls and sock puppets. And she is, according to some researchers, her account was linked to other accounts that were known sort of Russian trolls on Twitter, for instance, in social media. So part of this is just to also, amplify messages that are already out there and articles that are out there and get them spread within the social media universe.
It's worth listeners looking at they've deleted the Alice Donovan's corpus from their site and put up instead a piece called "Go Ask Alice: The Curious Case of Alice Donovan." She has kind of a porny Twitter profile image and otherwise a very dubious, online presence, as you say, she's just one example, but it is pretty interesting that she, where her first pieces were on Syria and other places, they then change to kind of pro WikiLeaks, you know, amplification of the would-be scandal around Hillary Clinton. So that's Alice Donovan. We don't know how much influence that has on things, but we do know that, you know, she was sticking to the party line that that you know, Hillary was a disaster and was virtually criminal. You know, and this is Counterpunch comes under, you know, it's a lefty site. It says it's fearless muckraking since 1993. And probably someone who has seemingly counterintuitive opinions, you know, against the pro-Assange and against the Democratic Party is going to seem appealing in some ways.
Right.
She had, you know, one thing that people who say they would never fall for bots or never fall for fake news, one of the reasons I think common wisdom is that no one can capture a true American idiom. They can't write in a way that sounds, you know, organically American. But, you know, she seems, when I read her prose, it sounds not unlike Fox News. You know, it doesn't sound like, you know, the Washington Post, but it sounds, you know, whatever. The emails have exposed Hillary Clinton in a major way. And almost no one is reporting on it. Sounds like our president, you know.
Well, and then interestingly, after the election, some of her articles took on an anti-Trump administration tone. Some of the articles criticizing the administration's policies in Syria and, you know, accusing the administration of being terrorists, you know, for opposing Assad's government. So that kind of showed, again, that the Kremlin's goal is really not so much just to have elected Trump, but to you know, stoke sort of the divisions in this country and keep people divided and just foment discord. That's the real goal.
That seems really important to bring up, because whenever the you know, dossier comes up or Facebook's, you know, possible complicity, so the Trump administration says, well, if there's any time that they had an anti-Trump message or seemed to be working for Democrats, then they're simply partisan,
right,
and can't be taken seriously. I mean, that shows an ignorance of how, well, it shows a lot of things, but one of them is an ignorance of how information, cyber warfare, information warfare works. And this piece is so extraordinarily well sourced. I mean, there's how many, you talk to so many people in intelligence, in the Trump administration, in a few cases, in publishing. One of the senior Trump officials who's anonymous in the piece says is, if the influence operations, if the information attacks changed one electoral vote, you know, you tell me. And then he gets on talking points that, incidentally, left, right and center have used, too. The Russians didn't tell Hillary Clinton not to campaign in Wisconsin. Tell me how many votes they changed in Michigan. And that the Democrats are just using, you know, this report in particular to delegitimize the presidency. You know, is there possibly any truth to that?
So that's a narrow gauge view. Yes, I mean, there's no evidence that the Russians actually, you know, for instance, they didn't change the votes in the voting machines. And it's really, really hard to know whether or not voters in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania or Michigan, whether any one of them changed a vote, cast a vote differently because of some ad they saw on Facebook or some tweet, you know, that a sock puppet put out. But the overall goal, I mean, when you look at what the Russians did by, you know, creating essentially secessionist movements in Texas and California, you know, or creating protests in New York and Texas, and just sort of doing the sorts of things that really created enmity and fired up the already fraught tensions and animosities that existed within the American society, and just enhanced them and turned people against one another even in starker fashion than they might have otherwise. I think that's what this influence operation aimed to do and succeeded at.
What do you think about, I was going to say, well, next year, but, you know, beginning 4 days mm-hmm. from now, 2018 and 2020's elections, the piece does not paint a rosy picture for defense against these kind of operations in those years. I mean, we have not exactly rallied and learned our lesson yet.
No, it's a difficult one to figure out. I mean, I certainly think the first order of business is to raise public awareness and to really have the American public people understand what it is Russia was up to, what they were trying to do and how they were trying to do it. You know, having information is probably the first line of defense.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe the American public, being a little more educated, can look at some of the things they're seeing on Facebook or on social media and on websites, and try to read and evaluate with a little more of a critical lens
mm-hmm.
to try to understand, you know, what's going on here. I know that in some countries in Eastern Europe, like Estonia, which has long been a target for Russian influence. I mean, it has a large Russian-speaking population there. One of the reasons they say that their country is a little bit more inured to it mm-hmm. than others is that the people there are very well aware now, having, you know, lived for decades under the in the Soviet sphere of influence, they're aware of what the Russians do and how they do it, and the Russian speaking population, in fact, is also they're slightly less susceptible because they really don't want to go and, you know, go back and live in Russia. They don't want to be part of Mother Russia. They
mm-hmm.
they prefer their sort of quality of lifestyle they have in the West and in Estonia. So, you know, if our ground is fertile right now, maybe we need to find a way to make it less fertile to sort of the Russians' efforts.
This is great. Thank you so much. The piece is fantastic. It's called Kremlin Trolls Burned Across the Internet as Washington Debated Options. Ugh, it's just like terrifying, but also illuminating to have such a well-reported piece. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
My guest has been Ellen Nakashima. She covers national security for The Washington Post. That's it for today's show. Trumpcast Today was produced by the great Verilyn Williams. Jason DeLeon will be back next week. Today is our last show of 2017. Now, before the year is out, I have one assignment for you. Follow us on Twitter at RealTrumpCast. We do the best tweets. They're tremendous. Thanks for listening to Trumpcast. I'm Virginia Heffernan. Have a great new year and see you in 2018.